And welcome back. This is Daily Buddhism, episode number 43. My name is Brian Schell, and I'm your host for the show. You can find the text, as well as all links mentioned in this program, and of course, all past episodes, on the website at www.dailybuddhism.com. First, a couple of announcements. Last week, I played a recorded question from the voicemail hotline and forgot to mention that the caller, Timothy, had won a free month of the Weekly Buddhism PDF magazine for his efforts. Sorry about that. Timothy, drop me a note and I'll set up your subscription. I'll even throw in a fifth week because of my goof. But, as I mentioned last time, this week we'll be covering all the basics of Buddhism. On this episode of the show, we'll look at some facts about Buddhism, talk about the life of Buddha, and have a look at what he had to say, and finally, see how to live according to the rules. That's a lot for one show, and this will probably be the longest episode ever, but I think it's worth doing it in one big chunk, because when this episode's done, you'll know all the ideas that underlie about 90% of everything else in Buddhism. This is really the foundations of everything. So now, let's get on with this week's material. Well, probably the logical place to start is, what is Buddhism? Well, Buddhism is a path of real-world practices and internal spiritual development, which lead to insight into the true nature of life. Practices such as meditation are means of changing oneself in order to develop and perfect the qualities of awareness, kindness, and wisdom. The methods developed within the Buddhist tradition over thousands of years have created an incredible array of resources for all those who wish to follow the path, which ultimately culminates in enlightenment or Buddhahood. The foundation of Buddhism is the fourfold noble truth. 1. The world is full of suffering and stress. 2. The cause of this suffering and stress is desire and irrational grasping. 3. If this desire can be removed, then suffering and stress will be ended. And 4th, desire and stress can be removed by following the Noble Eightfold Path, which is made up of right views, right speech, right livelihood, right mindfulness, right thoughts, right conduct, right effort, and right concentration. We'll talk more about that later. But because Buddhism does not include the idea of worshiping a god, some people do not consider it a religion at all, but more of a philosophy. The basic teachings of Buddhism are straightforward and practical. Nothing is permanent. Actions have consequences. But change is possible. Thus, Buddhism addresses itself to all people, irrespective of race, nationality, or gender. It teaches practical methods such as meditation, which enable people to make use of its teachings in order to transform their lives, to be fully responsible for those lives, and to develop the desirable qualities of wisdom and compassion. Buddhism began around 523 BC, and the historical Buddha, known as Shakyamuni Buddha by name, was a Hindu from northern India. His birthplace, Lumpini, is now part of Nepal. The Bible of Buddhism is called the Tripitaka, or the Three Baskets, and it is formed of the Sutta, or Sutras, of the Buddha, the Vinaya, which are the precepts for the Sangha, or worshippers, and the Abhidhamma, which are the higher teachings, or analytical writings about higher states. Don't worry about that too much. We'll talk later. The oldest existent manuscripts date back to about the 1st century BC, and there are many various sects of Buddhism. They all place more or less emphasis or value on written scriptures. Some are very heavily into the ancient writings. Some don't fool with ancient writings much at all. There are approximately 362 million Buddhists in the world. There are many different forms of Buddhism, which developed and grew as it spread from India and Nepal throughout Asia. The three main vehicles are Theravada, which is sometimes also known as Hinayana, Mahayana and Tantrayana, which is also sometimes known as Vajrayana. Theravada is the oldest tradition and is practiced predominantly in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, Cambodia, and Laos. Theravada practice has the goal of reaching the state of nirvana, becoming an arhat, and achieving liberation from the cycle of rebirth. Mahayana predominates in northern India, China, Japan, and Vietnam. Tantrayana predominates in Tibet, Nepal, and Mongolia. Both Mahayana and Tantrayana practice is primarily to help all sentient beings reach enlightenment, and in so doing, achieve both nirvana and Buddhahood. In Tantrayana, additional tantric practices are used in order to achieve Buddhahood more quickly. And there is a brief overview of what is Buddhism. If you didn't quite catch all that, don't worry about it. We'll cover the important parts as we go on. Okay, the next big question would have to be, who was Buddha? The legend of Buddha's life has been told and retold for thousands of years. There are versions of the story that are very fanciful and magical, and others that are more down-to-earth and realistic. Nothing was written down during the Buddha's lifetime, so everything we know today came secondhand. Don't be too attached to the factuality of the story, as most of it is probably just mythological embellishment. It's okay to say that in Buddhism. There is a lot of mythology involved with Buddhism, and it's completely unnecessary to believe any of it to follow Buddhism. The accuracy of the story is not really the point, but you should know the details of the story in order to understand much of what's been written about Buddha and Buddhism. Okay, here is probably the most commonly told version of the tale. Around 2,500 years ago, King Suddhodana Gautama of the Shakya clan ruled in northern India. He built a great castle and ruled his people justly and well. One night, his wife, Queen Maya, had a strange dream wherein she saw a white elephant enter her womb through the side of her chest. She soon found that she was indeed pregnant. The people of the kingdom were thrilled there would now be a royal heir. Planning to have a child at her parents' home, Maya traveled there before the birth. Legend states that on April 8th, on the way to Queen Maya's ancestral home, she stopped to rest in a garden. Reaching for a blossoming branch in the garden, she suddenly, painlessly, had the child. Unfortunately, a few days later, Queen Maya died. The baby was named Siddhartha, which means every wish fulfilled, and was raised within his father's grand castle. His father, of course, expected young Siddhartha to succeed him as king at some point in the future. Fate, however, had other plans for Siddhartha. A wandering holy man came to the castle to see the king. He had had a vision concerning the young prince and went to tell the king. He foretold that the young boy had two possible futures, either as a great king who would rule the entire world, or as a great holy man. The king decided immediately that his son would not leave the castle and learn to be the great future king. He wanted nothing to do with his son being a holy man. Young Siddhartha lived in the castle and grew up inside his protective walls, never seeing anything that would make him think of a spiritual or religious things. His father was careful to remove all hints of real suffering that accompany this world. The prince lived a perfectly shielded life. His father arranged a marriage, and then Siddhartha had a son of his own. But not long after, on a parade through the city, he spotted four sights that forever changed his life. First, he saw a sick man. He had never been sick, or even seen sickness before, and it shocked him. He asked his good friend and charioteer, "Will I become sick?" And the charioteer answered truthfully, "Yes, eventually we will all get sick." They continued through the city, and the prince spotted a very old man. Never having seen an old person before, he asked, "Will I grow old like that man?" To which the charioteer answered similarly. Lastly, he saw a dead man being carried away in a funeral procession. "Will I die?" he asked, and he didn't like the answer. Then he saw a wandering holy man begging for food and telling people who would listen how to be good and live in peace. This struck Siddhartha as the best way to live, so he decided to become a wandering monk. That very night, leaving his wife and young son behind, Siddhartha abandoned the castle and went off to live in the wilderness as a wandering holy man. He met up with 5 other ascetic mendicants, monks who had refused to eat and would spend all day meditating and denying all worldly pleasures. For 6 years, he studied with these ascetics, and nearly starved to death in the process. But after 6 years studying in this manner, he finally decided that he would learn no more following this path. He decided that denying the world was wrong, but that enjoying life too much, as in his younger days, was bad as well. He decided to follow a middle path. His friends, the other 5 mendicants, abandoned him, since he no longer believed as they did. They called him weak for giving up that lifestyle. He then sat alone beneath a Bodhi tree and meditated. During this meditation, he was tempted in many ways to abandon his search for truth and live a life of pleasure. He rejected every temptation and continued his struggle to know. At last, he succeeded, becoming enlightened under the Bodhi tree, and the world would never be the same for him. At 35 years old, he became a Buddha, or one who is awake. He met up with his 5 former mendicant friends, and he quickly convinced them that his path was real, and they became his first followers. He then traveled to the countryside, teaching his ways, and word quickly spread about this man who taught the path to enlightenment. He soon had many thousands of followers, and he was eventually reunited with his father, wife, and son, and they too became followers of his way. He traveled around teaching for decades, and at around age 80, he died from eating some spoiled food. He foresaw his death, but continued teaching as always until the very moment of death. He closed his eyes and in perfect peace moved on to nirvana. Stories about his life, his teachings, and his path were eventually written down, and his followers continued to spread the message for the next 2,500 years. Since then, people have known him by many names: Siddhartha, Gautama, Buddha, Shakyamuni, Enlightenment, Tathagata, and many others. He's not a god, he's just a man, but the greatest teacher of all time. So the next thing to look at is what exactly Buddha had to say. What did he come up with that was so important? Well, the very foundation of Buddhism is the 4 Noble Truths that Buddha invented. I can't think of a better place to start than these ideas. This is really the heart of Buddhism. The first Noble Truth is that in life there is much suffering. Buddha later explained this to include suffering during birth, aging, illness, death, association with unpleasant people and conditions, separation from loved ones, separation from pleasant conditions, and inability to possess what one desires. And everyone experiences these things. Doesn't matter how rich or poor, healthy or sickly you are, everyone runs into this kind of suffering. Many people, hearing this most basic rule of Buddhism, immediately come to the conclusion that Buddhism is a negative, pessimistic thing, a depressing idea, a real downer. And this is not the case. Buddha expanded on the idea of suffering by taking into consideration that all happiness is temporary. Everything is in fact temporary. The idea is what Buddhists call impermanence. No matter what you have, who you love, or what you do, eventually you're going to lose it. You'll grow old and suffer. Your friends and family will die. The great works you have done in your life will fade from memory. You will eventually die. You can build a stone monument that lasts 3,000 years, but it too will eventually turn to dust. Yes, it's depressing, but you have to admit that it's true. Buddha, coming from a background as a Hindu, took that second idea of suffering and expanded it infinitely. If so much of life is suffering, then what does rebirth add to that mix? The answer is eternal suffering. Once you die and get a little relief in this life, the cycle starts all over again. Now keep in mind, when I say suffering, I'm poorly translating the word dukkha, which does mean suffering, but it also means imperfect and unsatisfying, as well as grasping. So here's one translation of Buddha's own explanation. Now this is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Illness is suffering. Death is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. Separation from what is pleasing is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. Some teachers will go so far as to say the first noble truth is all life is suffering. This is not the case. Buddha mentioned specific kinds of suffering that are experienced by everyone. He was not making sweeping generalization that life sucks. He was not saying this in any way, but there are specific types of suffering that everyone experiences. This is what Buddha was talking about. Now, this idea of suffering is hard to accept because we have been raised to think of life and the world as basically a good thing. And this is true to a certain extent. We can be happy for a while. But you always know in the back of your mind that sooner or later the happiness will end. This really is some depressing and sad stuff. Fortunately, Buddha found the reason for this suffering and figured out a way to defeat it. The Buddha wanted to cure the condition of suffering in the world, and he did. But just like any doctor, before he could cure the suffering, he had to diagnose the cause of the suffering. And the second noble truth is the idea that there is a single cause to suffering, attachment. Again, all things are impermanent. No matter how much you love your car, or your dog, or your family, someday you'll lose them, or you'll die yourself and thereby lose everything you have. Nothing is permanent. Nothing. I don't like it, you probably don't like it either, but that's not up to us. Attachments to things, and the resultant loss of these things, causes suffering. If you've ever lost a loved one, you know exactly what I mean. But you don't actually have to lose someone to suffer, because you know, deep down, that someday you're going to lose them. That thought is always in the back of your mind. Death is a part of living, and we have mostly accepted that idea. The idea that suffering comes about from attachment is very logical, and if you think it through, I think you'll agree. All suffering comes from attachment, or put in another way, desire. I desire a new Ferrari, but I can't afford it. I suffer because I cannot have what I want. If I'm hungry, all I have to do is go to the kitchen and make a sandwich. But right now, I'm desiring food, and that little bit of hunger is still a mild form of suffering. Now, poor people around the world are hungry too, but they don't have sandwiches handy. They suffer too, albeit more seriously than I do. I'd like to date a supermodel, but they wouldn't give me the time of day. Or maybe my sights aren't so high, and I just have a crush on the girl next door. But she hates me. There's more suffering. Greed, lust, anger, ignorance, and even emotions we think of as positive such as love, are still forms of attachment or clinging. There's no way around it. Even Buddha himself got hungry and had physical needs. And what about physical pain? That's attachment as well. You're attached to your own body, believing that this life is somehow real. Your body is not you. It's just another temporary vessel. And we'll discuss this further another time, but your attachment to yourself is just as bad as aching with lust for that supermodel. Think about it for yourself. Don't take my word for it. This is something you can meditate on forever. It's a very large, very complicated subject. But you'll find that everything about essential Buddhism is completely logical when you dwell on it and analyze it a bit. Think about various forms of suffering and see how they can be traced back to desire, attachment, or clinging of one form or another. Okay, now we know that the world is full of suffering and the cause of all desire and attachment. These are important ideas to really understand and think through. But the third noble truth is that the idea of suffering can be beaten. We know from the first two truths that everyone, everywhere, is suffering in one way or another, and that all this suffering is related to attachment and desire. Dr. Buddha first identified the problem, suffering. Then he found the cause of the sickness, attachment. So the next step was to prescribe a cure. Yes, there is a way to beat this depressing cycle of misery that we've been talking about. Most people haven't attained this, and most won't in this lifetime. But let's see if we can work it out on our own. As I said, it's all pretty easy once you think about it. Since suffering is the problem that we're trying to beat, and suffering is caused by attachment and desire, then it seems likely that the way to beat suffering is to control desire and limit attachments. Attachments and desire come from within. They're caused by our own minds. If we have control of our own minds, we should be able to just shut off the suffering. And in fact, Buddhists go so far as to claim that reality is what you make of it. Simple, huh? Well, no, of course not. But this idea that everything is in your mind, and that you need to learn to control your mind, is the heart of Buddhism. But there is a way to do it, and Buddha went on to explain it in the fourth noble truth. Just to summarize, we now know that life is full of suffering. This life is caused by attachments and desire. Yet there is a way to end this suffering. To continue our medical analogy, Dr. Buddha saw the problem, identified the cause, and then prescribed a cure. And now we're going to discuss the cure. The fourth noble truth is the path, or way, that ends suffering. This prescription to end all suffering is usually called the Eightfold Path, because it has eight steps or components. These eight components are right thought, right speech, right actions, right livelihood, right understanding, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This path is also sometimes called the middle way because it goes directly between all opposite concepts. It's the middle way between asceticism and self-indulgence. By focusing on perfecting these eight components, you can attain enlightenment and be released from all suffering. This is what's called attaining nirvana, or enlightenment. Buddha once said, "I teach about suffering and the way to end it." And that's true. Much of the Four Noble Truths seems very negative and depressing. But it's not about the suffering. It's all about ending the suffering. And that is definitely a positive way to look at things. And now we'll take a closer look at the Eightfold Path. The path to enlightenment, set down by the Buddha. Well, the first step is right view. The first two steps on the path, right view and right intention, are often paired together and called the wisdom portion of the path. Right speech, action, and livelihood fall into the ethical conduct category. And right effort, mindfulness, and concentration are considered mental discipline. So between wisdom, ethics, and mental discipline, the Eightfold Path covers all the important stuff a Buddha should focus on. Right view is also sometimes called right perspective, right vision, or right understanding, depending on what you're looking at. It's all about having the right perspective on yourself and the universe. You need to see the world and yourself as they truly are, not what you've been conditioned to see. Much of this relates to really understanding the Four Noble Truths, understanding that nothing is permanent or perfect, to think through karma and all the effects it has on you. Having the proper way of looking at the world is especially crucial to a Buddhist, since your perspective actually shapes your life and how you live it. It's important that in perfecting your right view, that you clear out your misunderstandings, misconceptions, and confusion. Keep an open mind, and look at everything in a critical manner. Step 2 is right intention. Right intention is sometimes also called right thought, right resolve, right aspiration, or the exertion of our own will to change. And it involves your commitment and your reasons for following the tenets of Buddhism. Do you really want to give up desire and attachments? Are you willing to make sacrifices to attain enlightenment? Are you willing to give up anger, hatred, and negative feelings while embracing compassion? Are you willing to avoid doing harm to others? Eightfold Path Step 3, Right Action. Right action is also sometimes called right conduct, and involves how to behave in the physical world from day to day. Some examples of the rules are to avoid killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. This idea leads us right into another famous Buddhist list called the Five Precepts, which we'll examine in a little bit. The idea behind right action is that improper physical actions lead to an unsound mind, so that in order to have a sound mind and attain enlightenment, one should act properly with a physical body. In another way of looking at the five precepts, all of the rules involve physical attachments and desires, and as we've just seen with the Noble Truths, desire and attachment is the Buddhist's root of all evil. Step 4 is right speech. One important Buddhist scripture explains, what is right speech? Abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech, abstaining from abusive speech, abstaining from idle chatter. This, monks, is called right speech. And this is all very simple to understand. It pretty much follows the old adage, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. It's better to live your life under a vow of silence. Yes, Buddhists have those too. Than it is to hurt others or yourself through your words. In practice, this is one of the harder points of the Eightfold Path to follow. Watch yourself today and tomorrow. See how easy it is to complain, to gossip, or even just waste time talking about nothing. Step 5 is another tough one. Right livelihood. Right livelihood is the goal of trying to make a living with right thought, speech, and actions. You don't have to give up everything and become a propertyless monk, but no Buddhist practitioner should engage in trades or occupations which either directly or indirectly result in harm to other living beings or systems. Okay, now think about your job. Is anyone anywhere harmed, either physically, emotionally, or mentally, because of what you do for a living? How about animals? If you analyze your life, you're probably going to see how you live at someone else's expense. In my opinion, this is probably one part of the Eightfold Path that was much easier to accomplish back in Buddha's day than it is now. Today, everyone is so interdependent that it is extremely hard to live without doing some damage to someone, somewhere. But you need to try. Step 6 is right effort. Right effort is also known as right endeavoring. and he concerns the Buddhist practitioner's continuous effort to keep his or her mind free of thoughts that might impair his or her ability to realize or put into practice the other elements of the Eightfold Path. I have mentioned in the past that Buddhists believe that reality bends to his own perspective of it. By an effort of mind, a Buddhist can shape his reality. This can be a double-edged sword, creating both wholesome and unwholesome conditions. Right effort concerns making the conscious effort to positively shape our minds and our world. The same type of mental energy that fuels desire, envy, aggression, and violence can, on the other side, fuel self-discipline, honesty, benevolence, and kindness. Right effort consists of four major actions that a Buddhist should attempt at all times. First, make an effort to prevent the creation of unwholesome states. Try not to think of bad things. 2. Make an effort to abandon pre-existing unwholesome states. It's been going on for a while, see if you can make it stop. 3. Make an effort to encourage wholesome states. And 4. Make an effort to maintain pre-existing wholesome states. Step 7 is right mindfulness. And right mindfulness is also translated as right memory. Together with concentration is concerned broadly with the practice of meditation. Roughly speaking, mindfulness refers to the practice of keeping the mind alert to phenomena, both internal and external, as they are affecting the body and mind. It concerns seeing yourself and the universe as it really is. Right mindfulness requires clear perception, and it penetrates impressions, both correct and incorrect. Right mindfulness enables us to be aware of the process of how our own minds work in such a way that with practice we can actively observe and control the way our thoughts go. Buddha accounted for this as the four foundations of mindfulness. 1. The contemplation of the body. 2. The contemplations of feelings. 3. The contemplations of the state of mind. And 4. The contemplations of the phenomena. Eightfold Path Step 8. Right Concentration. Right concentration, together with right mindfulness, is still, again, concerned broadly with the practice of meditation. According to the Pali Canon, one of the classic Buddhist scriptures, right concentration is dependent on the development of the preceding steps along the Eightfold Path. The Blessed One said, "Now what, monks, is noble right concentration with its supports and requisite conditions? Any singleness of mind equipped with these seven factors, right view, right resolve, right speech, right actions, right livelihood, right effort, and right mindfulness, is called noble right concentration with its supports and requisite conditions." Okay, concentration, in this context, is a state where all mental faculties are directed on one particular object or point. Right concentration for the purposes of the Eightfold Path means concentration on wholesome thoughts and actions. Meditation is the primary path to achieving right concentration, and most Buddhists practice meditation extensively. As we've seen, there's many forms of meditation, but most Buddhists practice it in some form. With enough practice meditating, it becomes natural to apply elevated levels of concentration also in everyday situations. Okay, as we just saw, the third step on the Eightfold Path was right action. There were certain rules that you have to perform to do right actions. The most common list of rules, if you want to call them that, is called the Five Precepts. Now first, I'm going to point out that some groups of Buddhists have 8 precepts, and some have 10. But these 5 are universal and apply to all Buddhists of every group. Everyone follows these 5. These rules apply not only to monks, but to lay people like you and me as well. The 5 precepts are the rules of behavior, much like the Judeo-Christian Ten Commandments. These are the things you cannot do. These five precepts are often written and recited as a vow, repeated regularly by the Buddhist. The recitation goes like this. I undertake the precept to refrain from destroying living creatures. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. I undertake the precept to refrain from incorrect speech. I undertake the precept to refrain from intoxicating drinks and drugs which lead to carelessness. And these are sometimes shortened to say no killing, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, no lying, and no drinking. But this is oversimplifying things a bit. So let's look at all five of these one at a time. The first precept is to refrain from destroying living creatures. Killing causes suffering, and we already know the Buddhist perspective on suffering. Now, this is a lot harder than it may appear at first. At first glance, you're probably thinking it matches up with the biblical thou shalt not kill. Actually, the biblical commandment more correctly translates to thou shalt not murder, and really only applies to humans. The first precept, however, applies to all living creatures. All life is valuable. One very famous modern-day Buddhist teacher is Thich Nhat Hanh, a monk from Vietnam. He's written dozens of fantastic books on Buddhism, and I strongly recommend any of them. But he's come up with his own modern translation of the five precepts, and we'll cover each of those here. Here is his version of the first precept. Aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I vow to cultivate compassion and learn ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, and not to condone any act of killing in the world, in my thinking and in my way of life. Okay, take some time and think this one through for yourself. There's a lot more to this than skipping the steak dinner or not going on a rampage killing your coworkers. This precept covers supporting wars, capital punishment, or even supporting governments that condone those things. And yes, Buddhists are often vegetarian, and most usually pacifists. And that comes directly from this first precept. The second of the Buddhist precepts is not to take that which is not given. Nope, stealing is a bad thing. But, living in a modern civilized society, we already knew that. But, just as with the first precept, there's more to it than it appears at first glance. Remember that one of the steps on the Eightfold Path was right livelihood. That means not making a living, taking or exploiting what is not yours. There's no cheating or stealing allowed either. Being lazy at work is even a form of stealing. You're taking time away from your job that you are being paid for. This also means that Buddhists encourage charitable giving. Give to the poor, the needy, and the sick. Give your money, give your time, and give as much as you can. You don't have to give everything you own, but selfishness and greed are really bad. Thich Nhat Hanh has this to say in his updated version of the precepts. Aware of the suffering caused by exploitation, social injustice, stealing, and oppression, I vow to cultivate loving-kindness and learn ways to work for the well-being of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I vow to practice generosity by sharing my time, energy, and material resources with those who are in real need. I am determined not to steal and not to possess anything that should belong to others. I will respect the property of others, but I will prevent others from profiting from human suffering or the suffering of other species on Earth. So as you can see, there's a lot more to this than just not stealing. Rule number 3 is no sexual misconduct. Well, how do you define misconduct? That depends on where you live. The social rules are different from country to country and region to region, and what's considered misconduct in America might be completely appropriate elsewhere in the world. That doesn't really matter so much. The real problem here is suffering. If something is inappropriate to the society you're in, then it needs to be avoided. If it's inappropriate and you do it, you cause suffering, whatever that may mean, depending on where you are. Self-restraint is crucial to being a Buddhist. Remember the Eightfold Path again. Right effort, right action, and right mindfulness all deal with self-control and restraint. So what does our new friend Thich Nhat Hanh have to say? Aware of the suffering caused by sexual misconduct, I vow to cultivate responsibility and learn ways to protect the safety and integrity of individuals, couples, family, and society. I am determined not to engage in sexual relations without love and a long-term commitment, to preserve the happiness of myself and others. I am determined to respect my commitments and the commitments of others. I will do everything in my power to protect children from sexual abuse and to prevent couples and families from being broken by sexual misconduct. He seems to enhance the importance of responsibility and commitment beyond simple sexual misdeeds. There's definitely an emphasis on commitment. Monogamous relationships and marriage are strongly advocated in Buddhism. Rule number 4 is to refrain from incorrect speech. Right speech, if you remember, was a step on the Eightfold Path all by itself. Not only is right speech promoted and valued with Buddhists, but here, wrong speech is singled out for special negative treatment. We all know how damaging our words can be. Buddhism is all about seeking truth, whatever that may be, and falsehoods work against that goal, often causing suffering in the process. Our words are powerful, and that's really all that needs to be said. Even Thich Nhat Hanh had little to really add to this precept. In his words, aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening in order to bring joy and happiness to others and relieve others of their suffering. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I vow to learn to speak truthfully, with words that inspire self-confidence, joy, and hope. I am determined not to spread news that I do not know to be certain, and not to criticize or condemn things of which I am not sure. I will refrain from uttering words that can cause division or discord, or that can cause the family or community to break. I will make all effort to reconcile and resolve all conflicts, however small. And the 5th rule is to avoid intoxicants. Why? The first glance answer is that drunks cause all kinds of suffering. Drug addicts harm everyone near them over and over again. This is bad behavior, and we all know it. Yet most of us are not alcoholics or drug addicts. But that doesn't let us off the hook. Mind-altering actions of all kinds, including smoking, coffee, caffeine, and other stimulants are also prohibited. Why? They affect your state of mind, and Buddhism is all about the mind. Your world is created by your own perceptions and mindfulness. If you change the way your mind works by the use of stimulants or mind-altering drugs, you're harming your own chances for enlightenment. These chemicals are also often bad for your physical health as well, and causing physical harm and suffering is bad, even if you're doing it to yourself. And Thich Nhat Hanh has added a lot to this one as well. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful consumption, I vow to cultivate good health, both physical and mental, for myself, my family, and my society, by practicing mindful eating, drinking, and consuming. I vow to ingest only items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy in my body, in my consciousness, and in the collective body and consciousness of my family and society. I am determined not to use alcohol or any other intoxicants, or to ingest foods or other items that contain toxins, such as certain TV programs, magazines, books, films, and conversations. I am aware that to damage my body or my consciousness with these poisons is to betray my ancestors, my parents, my society, and future generations. I will work to transform violence, fear, anger, and confusion in myself and in society by practicing a diet for myself and for society. I understand that a proper diet is crucial for self-transformation and for transformation of society. Yes, he really did just say that TV shows, conversations, and magazines can be toxic as well. He also suggests that a proper diet can be good for all of society. Alright, so we have seen a general overview of what is Buddhism, who was Buddha, what Buddha had to say, and the physical actions that you need to do. All of this is the foundation of Buddhism. Almost everything else has been built on top of this is optional or different from denomination or sect to denomination or sect. The things we've just talked about are global to all Buddhism. Some groups have additional precepts. Some focus more on scripture than others. Some have various rituals and religious beliefs. Some don't. There are lots of differences at this point. But what I've just covered in the past 45 minutes is common to everything Buddhist. So there you go. That was our Beginning Buddhism podcast. If you'd like to read this, you can pick up the Weekly Buddhism PDF magazine, which has a special issue covering all of this. It's a Getting Back to Basics issue. It has a special price this week, but you can normally subscribe to it on the www.weeklybuddhism.com or comment on anything you've heard here on individual posts at www.dailybuddhism.com. This show is supported completely by your donations. If you'd like to help out or if you've appreciated this podcast, please donate at www.dailybuddhism.com/donate. Anything you'd like to send will help. Thank you very much, and see you next week.